Today's daf in Masechet Ketuvot, brought to you from Eretz HaKedesh, and we're holding at the Halakha Mishnah on daf Memtes, Omud Aleph, and today's daf is daf Memtes, and let us begin. So, we have been engaged in this long journey to discover all of the ways in which the Torah has provided the basis for our entire focus in the Masechet, of making certain that there is protection for banot, and this starts at a very early age, and we have all types of various dinim, legabi a ketana, legabi a nara, legabi a bogeret, legabi an isha bebeit baala, and all of the various chiyuvim that exist beinav lebito, beinish leishto. And now we want to extend this into what is the dinim about child care. So this starts yet at an earlier age. As we've been talking about shiurim, which is ruyalavia and so on, what about just the ideas of just support? So the Mishnah says that as far as the diaraisa is concerned, the av ein ochayav b'mezonot bito. He isn't really responsible. Now we're going to see later on that this is only referring to older children, and that this statement is said from above the age of six or so. So he's not chayav at that point b'mezonot bito, but we expect, and we'll see later on in the Gemara, that we can utilize the chiyuvim of tzedakah, if the person has the money, to go after him to make certain that he pays for the mizonot bito. And in the Gemara, we're going to be searching for a reason. Now, we know the reason. We know the real reason. But remember, we can never deal with real reasons. We have to deal with the mechanism that makes sense behind the reason. We understand that the entire nature of the Masechet is focusing on Bito. But the problem is that there ought to be no difference between child support in terms of a male or a female, right? Because the vulnerability level should be essentially the same. And yet the Mishnah focuses on Bito. So we're going to have to explain what are the implications of saying Bito as opposed to Bino. Of course, the fact that it happens to fit in beautifully into the overall structure of the Masechet, in which the entire issue is built around Beinav Lebito, that's clear. So he's not really chayiv. However, Zeh Midrash Dorash Reb Elozer ben Azariah Lifnei Chachomim Bekerem Biyavna. So here they were, even in those days they had Barnea neighborhoods, and the place where the Sanhedrin was gullah to was originally into, as you all know the story about this time of the year, and the gullah Hashchina and the Sanhedrin had to go out before. So in Kerem B'Yavne, which we call a Kerem, as Rashi always says, because they were Shurais Ki Kerem, all the Chavrusas were lined up and they were learning, which is why El Roi is still there, you know, over there in Kerem B'Yavne. And they said the following drasha. Now, it isn't a drasha from a pasuk. And we know that the ketuvah was actually nidrash. We've already seen examples of that. And that the language that exists in a ketuvah is meant to be so specific that you can even be doresh it. So Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said that one of the Tnai HaKetuvah, remember, is the idea of Habanim Yirshu. Now, when it says Habanim Yirshu, that refers to a very specific takana. Again, we're missing Gavi. I don't know who's going to make the list over here, but please, somebody who comes up, either tell him or Moshe Forman to add this to the list. We're talking about over here the very special takana, which is called Ketuvat Benin Dichrin. Now, remember that we talked about earlier the takonas of the ketuvah that include providing support for an almana, but there's another issue, which is that in the event, the husband writes, in the event that I die and my children inherit me, then we've got a problem, because I have children that are not only necessarily from you, there may be children from another wife, you may have predeceased me, your children are running around together with other children, maybe from my third wife, I don't know. But what's going to be in terms of their sharing the Yerusha, taking into consideration the fact that when we got married, you invested from your father, and this is a continuation of what we were talking about before. At what point is that investment in the marriage chal, right? That's where, coming right out of that sugya. Suppose the father put in $100,000 into this marriage, and now the husband dies. It's 30 years later. He's got 10 kids, 3 kids from her, and then he's got another 7 kids from other women. What's going to happen to that money without a tnai in the ketuvah? All of his heirs are going to share all of her father's money. Now, this is a serious issue, because what it ultimately causes is that a father is reluctant to put too much money into a marriage where he has no idea where that money is going to end up. And therefore, one of the takonas of a ketuvah is that to guarantee a marriage and the smooth process of a parent investing in a marriage of a child, is that one of the important tnaim of the ketuvah, which, as I say, is basically a virtual document that is contained in every ketuvah, a very long and complex legal document. One of the clauses of a ketuvah is called the clause of benin dichrin, male children. And it reads, benin dichrin diyahavin lechiminoi, any male children, which would be my heirs, that you will have from me, inun yartun kesev ktuvatech yeter alchu kohon diim alchuhon, they will inherit outside of any other inheritance that will be shared by their brothers, they will take all of the money that's from you. So that means that those 3 children, besides getting the part, the 1/10 of a part of the father's among the other 10, the total of 10 siblings, which many of them are only half siblings, they will take all of the money that had been given by the family into the marriage from that first wife, or whichever wife we're talking about over here. They all get the same ketuvat benin dichrin. And that way a father knows when he's investing, the money will go to his grandchildren and will not be shared with other heirs of the same man who gave him those grandchildren. That's an absolutely brilliant takana. And what we want to be doresh is that the 2 clauses in the ketuvah are next to each other and are formulated in the same way. So one of them is called, as I said, ketuvat benin dichrin. The other clause is very similar, and what it's called is benan nukban, which are the female daughters. And what it says about benan nukban is that benan nukvan diyavin lechiminoi inun yavin yatvim bebeti umetzani minechasai adiit bagrun o atatilakhu lejuvrin. So remember that we spoke about this just recently in the context of the money that goes to the almanah. And what this is a guarantee that the daughters that grow up here, if I die, I don't care how many male heirs there are, these daughters of yours are going to be cared for from the estate, come hell or high water, and we saw that until they actually grow up or they're married. Now, we saw already before that that tnai is so powerful that if it's a toss-up between providing sufficient money for these girls until they grow up, that if there is insufficient money, which we've already mentioned to the missing Gavi, that that's called nechasim muatim, then you're not around, Gavi, dear, and we have to tell you more things to write. You can't afford to come late. You have already lost 63 different issues that were supposed to be on the list. Every moment counts. So we were talking about the Tanai. Please make sure that you fill in the Tanai of the Ketuvah that we're darshaning here in the Mishnah, the Tanai of the Ketuvah that's called Benin Dichrin, that is similar to the Tanai of Benot Nukvan. And this is the Tanai that the children, the girls, the Benot is about the girls getting married, and they're going to actually freeze out the male descendants if there's not enough money for both of them. As we said before, habanim yishalu al aptachim. Let them go begging money on the street corners and wash windshields. But we're going to give these girls enough to live on until they're married or until they're grown. So it points out this drasha, and the ksuva is something that is nidrash. The Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said in, this is, I'm repeating because so many people came late, in Kerem Beyavna, that since the ketuvah talks about these two tnaim as if they're similar, that the banim yirshu, that's benin dichrin, as we'll see, and the banot yizonu, it's meant to make a hekesh. That's right. We make a hekesh from a drasha in a ketuvah. And the hekesh is that ma habanim enim yorshim el alachar mitata av, af habanot en yizonot el alachar mitat aviyem. So in the same way that we know that the tnai, that is nogeya yerusha, is by definition, yerusha is inheritance and only starts after the death of the father, so too the part of the banot, in which he's guaranteeing support, is only after his death, which shows the opening words of the Mishnah, Ha'av eno chayav b'mizonot bito, in his lifetime. This is Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. So what does this mean in his daughter's parnasa? What's the difference between a son and a daughter? I mean, the mashma'ut is over here that b'mizonot bito hude eno chayav. It's only for daughters that he doesn't have to provide support. He is chayav. That's my first diak. We'll see if that's a correct diak. Furthermore, bito, what are we saying here? That we're saying that eno chayav bimizonot bito. That's mashma, though, that there is a mitzvah. So even though there's no court enforceable chiyav, but there definitely is a mitzvah to provide for his daughters. That's what it sounds like. So we have two very important diyukim here. Who is that Tana? Who is the Tana that makes a difference between the male and the female descendants in terms of child support? And who also says that in the event that there's no chov, there is still a mitzvah? Money masnisin doesn't seem to work out to any of the tanoim that we know are of opinions in this matter. We have three shitot. We have Rabbi Meir, we have Rabbi Yehuda, and we have Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. So let's go through them and see which one of them it might possibly be referring to. The Tanya, mitzvah lazon et habanot. There is a mitzvah to give to the daughters. Oh, okay, that sounds good so far. Kavachomer lebanim, and for sure, if there's a mitzvah to provide child support, then for boys, it's for sure true. De'aski b'torah. Devar Rabbi Meir, since they're being osik b'torah, we want to make sure that they have enough to be able to sustain them. That's Rabbi Meir. Uh-oh, that's a problem, because we were just medayik that there is a chovah, not just a mitzvah. We'll talk about that. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, on the contrary, there is a mitzvah to be mezin banim, but it's a kal v'chomer to the daughters, not a kal v'chomer to the boys. If you have to take care of boys, for sure you're going to have to take care of your girls, because mishum ziluta. Because girls are much more vulnerable, and therefore it's an absolute bizarion to have them out there on the street begging for food. That's an intolerable situation. That's a given. But here we're saying even for the boys. Though that's the opposite vision of Rabbi Meir. Then there's Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka says that actually there is a chov for girls, but only after death, which is exactly the way we've been just medayik in the Mishnah. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah showed that this is equivalent to the din of the Yerusha. And therefore, it's a din specifically achar mitat avien. Avo b'chaye avien, we don't find even a mitzvah. Elu ve'elu einan nizonin. Now, let me explain to you why not any one of those three Tanoim can possibly be the one who authors this Mishnah. Because let's start, okay? Money Masses, you tell me. Which Tana said this Mishnah? Rabbi Meir? No, because we were just medayek that there is no chovah. Isn't that what we said? But the, on the banot, but there is a mitzvah. Which is much, but the banim, there's an actual chovah. But Rabbi Meir said there's no chovah. He said there's a mitzvah. And in the Mishnah was mashma that there's a chovat. So it's not him. Is it Rabbi Yehuda? Rabbi Yehuda says that, Omar, that the bonim as well are a mitzvah. So that the idea, according to him, this is a little bit, the lushan is not very clear over here because it ought to say he also says bonim is a mitzvah, not Omar bonim nami. So it should say, and the Rosh Hashanah changes this to read, Ha Omar Nami Bani Mitzvah. He too agreed that the Banim are a mitzvah, and therefore it doesn't work out like him. And according to Rabbi Yochanan, it doesn't work out at all. He, Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, there is not even a mitzvah. And over here, the Mishnah is only coming to say that there's no chovah. We said, but the implication is that there definitely is a mitzvah. So which one of the Tanoim is this? Is there some other Tana that we don't know about? No. The truth is it could work out according to everyone. And the question is how you want to read that opening statement. Let's say it would go like Rabbi Meir, then it could mean like this. Ha'av eno chayav b'mizonot bito. Okay. That does not mean he is chayav in mizonot b'no. I'll tell you why it's talking about bito specifically. Well, I didn't even know. The diuk over here is that even though there's no chiyav, but there is a mitzvah for supporting his daughter. And that's a kal v'chomer. So I want to tell you, if I'm telling you that there's a mitzvah to support a daughter, kol shekein there's a mitzvah to support a son. I'm not telling you it's a chovah. I'm telling you there's a mitzvah to support a son because of the fact that they're oskei b'Torah. Fine. Why then did it mention the daughter? Because it's trying to tell us that even bito, that even for the daughter, that still, although not a chovah, it's still a mitzvah. You would have thought, okay, for the son, it's a mitzvah that we add on, even though it's not judicially applicable. But since they're learning Torah, it's like a mitzvah. No. It's a mitzvah for all children, whether it's banim or banot. And that's the diak, and that's the chiddush, that even for a bat, a mitzvah ika. That's the way that we could learn it according to Rabbi Meir. According to Rabbi Yehuda, we could also make it work out. We could say the Mishnah is trying to say this. Ha'av eno chayav b'mizonot bito, even though his daughter is vulnerable. Kol shekein, he's not chayav for a ben who is not as vulnerable. But you should know that there is a mitzvah. A mitzvah, but no, I'm just saying there is a mitzvah across the board. And for sure, there's a mitzvah for banot, because according to me, Reb Yehuda, banot are more vulnerable. So why did the Mishnah discuss over here bito, if it really wants to tell us a chiddush of the mitzvah, even on the less vulnerable banot? Hakamashmal on the Mishnah, according to Rabbi Yehuda, is coming to tell me that even though you would have thought maybe for a boy there's just a mitzvah, but for a girl there must be an absolute chiyav enforceable in court. No, kamashman afilu bito chova leka. So everybody could go along with what the Mishnah is saying. The two diyukim that you made are not necessarily true, because we need to focus on what the assumption would have been, and what the Mishnah is coming to tell us is not the case. And now the truth is it could work out perfectly well, Aliba to Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, because Hachikama, a father is not chayev b'mizonot bito, neither bito nor bino. And he doesn't even have a mitzvah the way Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. Why then does it talk about chova? And why then does it focus on the pot? If you're telling me it's the same, because, don't you understand? Since we know that there is a chiv that is based on the ketuvah itself, where the over there, after the death of the husband who wrote this ketuvah, it's an absolute chova. So, Aidi de Banot, la'achar mitat aviyem chova, the Mishnah wants to say, exactly as Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is working out, from the ksuva itself, you can be medayik, that this is only a din in inheritance, and therefore kicks in only as an equal to inheritance. And in reality, when he's alive, eino chayav, that because there I would have gotten confused about the chiyav of the banos l'achramisa as well. If he's providing for them after his death, so I guess he's providing for them during his lifetime, not true. These are two completely different issues. Omer Rabbi Lai, Omer Resh Lakish, Mishum Rabbi Yehuda Bar Chanina. That even though until now we have been walking with Barnea and Keren B'Yavne and going hand in hand with El Roi, we move on now to our next stop. And since Barnea is taking us on a Sanhedrin tour, we now find ourselves in Usha. And so in Usha comes along, Rabbi Loi, to say, you should know that all of this is all very nice if you want to stick with Barnea and Keren B'Yavne. However, once we go to Usha, then we made a takana about this. And they made a takana which says, Shiyehei Adam Zan et Banav et Benotav Kishehim Ktanim. It became an absolute chiyav d'oraisa, d'rabbanan, above and beyond the chiyav that we're going to see later on up until the age of six, which anyway was a chiyav, not dependent on Usha. This is a chiyav to give parnosa to children until they reach puberty. And that is Yei Adam Zanet Banavet Benotav Kishayim Kitanim, the first takana of Usha that we're mentioning here in a list of three takanas that Rabbi Loi is going to be speaking about. Iboyeluhu. Okay, that sounds great, but is that the halacha? Halacha kevate or in halacha kevate? So, do we in fact noyeg that way la halacha? Tashma, I will prove to you that actually the halacha is not like that, because we know of a number of cases where people, men who refused to support their children, were brought into court. And if the takana of Usha was correct, then the court would have a very easy time of it. All they have to do is go after his bank account or go after his salary, garnish his check, and pay for the kids. But instead of that, we find all types of public shaming, advertisements, and so on and so forth. And why would they have to do that if there was really a judicial mechanism? So I'll give you some examples. When they would come, a father who refused to provide support was dragged into court in front of Rabbi Yehuda, he would say to them, you know, the Yarud Yalda, you know what kind of animal has children and then throw them out and let others take care of them? The Yarud. What exactly the Yarud is? A Tanin. What a Tanin is, of course, modern Hebrew is an alligator or what, but seems to refer to some kind of mammal. They translate it in English.
Lizards.
Well, I mean, assuming that it's, as I said, that's the modern Hebrew. It's not the Pashtus and the Gemara and other places. But in any event, the Yarud, he gives birth and then he throws the kids out. You know, let other animals take care. That's what you're like, huh? Mr. Alligator, okay, or Mr. Jackal.
The jackal, yeah.
That's, and they translate as jackal, but again, I don't really know what the marker is for that. And I don't know what this idea that a jackal doesn't support his children is either. I don't know where that would come from. But anyway, so you see that he was pretty desperate to put this guy into the social spotlight to increase social pressure on him. And he didn't use any kind of power of Beis Din to go after his bank account. Now, if Rabbi Eloy was correct that this was a takana in Usha, why would he have to take on all of this time? He could have just taken care of it. And another maisa was when they would bring a father like that in front of Rav Chisda, he would say, "Kafule asita betzibura." We insist that we turn upside down a mortar, you know, that they mix cement in public. In other words, stand up on a soapbox and say, or some say that Shliach Beis Din was told to say this, "Veleikum velema." Let him say, "An urva boy bone, vahu gavra lo boy bone." Let the man announce that, listen, even the orev, even a raven, ooh, those mean ravens, even a raven wants its children, not me. I don't want any children. That's what you should say. Okay, so we see that the most that we could do is try to shame the guy. Wait a minute. You're telling me that a raven likes its children? V'urva boy bunny, the ravens want children? Doesn't it say in the pasuk, "Livnei orev asher yikro," that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he has to feed these little raven chicks because apparently mommy and daddy aren't taking care of them. So how do you explain that? If it says that you're going to use Dafka the raven, that's the one thing in the pasuk that says that he doesn't have. This is really strange. I mean, if this guy's smart, he knows exactly how to answer, right? He'll just quote the pasuk and say, "Let the boys go and speak to HaKadosh Baruch Hu the way the pasuk says." You don't want to do this on Rosh Chodesh, that's for sure. Answers the Gemara, Mokash, it depends if you're talking about white ravens or you're talking about black ravens. Now, they're very different. I'm sure all of you know that there is a old wives' tale that, you know, people really believe this, that white raven mothers eat their children. I'm sure you've heard this, right? Which is like this incredible Baba Maisa. But it's built on the idea that white ravens have problems. So now the question is, what are we talking about? Rashi understands that what this is a reference to, the difference between a white raven and a black raven, is part of the normal growth pattern of ravens. So that when they're originally born, they have a whitish tinge to their feathers. And because of that, they're rejected by the parents who don't see them as valid heirs. What? White? We're against white. Black is beautiful, as any raven will tell you. And therefore, they're not going to feed them. But then gradually, says Rashi, as their feathers turn properly black, mommy says, "Oh, look, a beautiful black baby. Exactly what I always wanted." And then she does start taking care of them. So this is a little bit strange in Darwinian terms, you must admit. However, you need to know that there actually is a basis for this. And this is, it's very strange, but apparently there is a genetic phenomena called white ravens that are not albino ravens, and they have a hard time of it socially. I haven't been able to find any evidence that mothers eat white ravens or anything like that, nor that it's part of the standard way for a nice little raven to grow up. But it's interesting that the Gemara should talk about something that's become this modern folk. I don't know how modern it is, but I mean, it is a modern folk tale. I don't know how far back it goes, but it's interesting. Anyway, Tosfos learns, and as you remember from Chulin, this is the simple explanation. The Gemara over there talks about the white raven that in part of the dinim of the Orev, that there is a white raven that flies in front. This, all of that was remuzim to to the idea of the Orev and the Dinim of Ta'aruva. It appears in Gidnasha and Per Gidnasha, and has to do with Esav, and that they always present themselves as being, you know, the lily white Yisrael, and they fly in front, which is Yavar and Adonilif. Anyway, those are the Pshatim that we said over there in Chulun. But Tosfos says that that's what it's referring to over here. It's a different species of raven, and that's a problem. But we're talking about, in the Beis Din over here, we're talking about black is beautiful ravens. Okay, and I'll tell you another Beis Din that did not see that they had any ability to force judicially compliance with a takana of Usha, which Rabbi Loi says existed, and apparently they did not implement it at all, because ki aviyate lekami de Rava, Rava would say to the person, and here it's talking about, according to the Mepharshim, it's talking about someone who was actually, would have been ashamed because he had a lot of money personally. And he said to him, is it really nechalecha de mitzani b'neich mitzadaka? You want us to right now assign part of the tzedakah, the community tzedakah fund to your family? This is going to make you feel proud? Because it was also a getter of social pressure, but it didn't force him. Now, all of this, by the way, is only mitzad the specific din of taking care of children. However, if somebody is in a matzav of being rich enough to require his participation in charity efforts over there, lo amr lo amid, if this guy has got money, we can go ahead and kafinan le al korche. Because if we're going to force him in court to provide money for charity for orphans in town, let's say, and it was one of the charitable efforts of the town, is taking care of the sick, is burying the poor who didn't have any money for a funeral, taking care of orphans, and so on and so forth. All of those things are standard community chest issues. That community chest is a chiyav, and they could be mechayev a person to participate in. It's a kol shekein under the rubric of that charity. You could be mechayev, and we're going to be mechayev to take care of the neighbor's children. And kol shekein, we're going to be mechayev to take care of his own children. Ki oda rova kafila reb nasan barami, v'ofik minei arba me'ezuzi le'tzedakah. Rova was collecting for a community chest. And he forced Reb Nosson Barami, who was a rich guy, he took from him, he took 400 zuz. Now this is an interesting shaila, because as Tosis points out, in general we have a klal that any mitzvah, shematan sichara, katuv bitzida, so where it says at the mention of the Mishnah, the Torah, the mitzvah, the Torah mentions the schar that you'll get, Laman Yivarecha, various psukim that talk about the tzedakah and the great sechar of tzedakah, then Beis Din doesn't get involved. Because Beis Din involves itself where the Torah is not offering the person what appears to be an option. You want a bracha, you want to live, you want whatever, then do this. Fine, okay, so then Beis Din says, all right, so that's what the pasuk says, do this. You don't want to do this, you drop dead, but it's not our business, right? So how come in this case there is an ability to force the guy to give tzedakah? So one of Tosfos's interesting explanations of this is the fact that there is also a law of lo ta'ametzit levavacha and so on, lo tikpotzit yadcha. Beis Din always forces a person not to be over in his lav. And what the klal about matan schor betzidah is referring to is specifically a mitzvah taseh. Just a very interesting sidelight. Anyway, once we're talking about the Takanas Usha, Rabbi Loi's Takanas Usha, which appears here not to have gone into effect, we want to talk about the second Takanas Usha that Rabbi Loi mentions. Omer Rabbi Loi, Omer Reish Lakish, Usha Hitkinu. Now, this is a fascinating thing that is very contemporary and comes up, unfortunately, quite often. That HaKotev Kol Nechasav Libanav Some people make the mistake of trying to protect their money from taxes by giving it over as a gift to children. The children go right ahead and starve them to death and don't give them even enough money to live on. So in Usha, one of the takanas was that if somebody does that, that nonetheless, he writes it as a total gift, that nonetheless, hu v'ishto nizoni mehem. He and his wife can actually force those children to provide support. And that is a tremendous chiddush, as we will see, because it means that even in a situation, and this is a fascinating, this is a bit complicated, and please just pay attention for 1 minute because you'll see exactly what's going on. What is the status of a husband in the issues that were brought in by a wife into his marriage? Is he considered to be the recipient of a gift, or is he considered to be a buyer? Now, remember, there's a tremendous difference. The recipient of a gift cannot go after someone who himself bought something and can show that he had a lien to. He can't go after Lekuchos to recover his purchase. So in the event, let's say the father promised, you know, so he's going to be giving such and such a field to him, and then somebody goes and buys it. Can he go and get it from a lekuach or not? Well, that depends. If it's a gift, so then he can't, because a gift doesn't provide you rights of tiruv. But if it's actually a purchase, then you can. So the idea over here is that normally, in a case where someone dies, the halacha is that his, in general, we give the husband the din of a lekuach, just to be mechazik. Now, if the husband dies, and now he leaves a almana, and he also leaves a daughter. The daughter goes ahead and gets married. So what we said is that the almana, she, remember, comes first, and she gets her parnasa from the daughter who inherited him. Now, what happens in that case if the husband inherits the daughter? Now, the pashtus is that the husband should then become a buyer. The moment that the daughter gets this gift, so now he's a buyer. In this case, the man who gave the gift and his wife, who are now left bereft because they gave everything away to their daughter, and now the husband's in control of it, and he doesn't want to give any money to his daughter's parents. It's saying over here that they nonetheless, they can go and they can take it. And that would normally not be true. It's only true if it's a din in Yerusha. So that means that the Chachamim here in Usha provided a halacha that stripped the husband of his rights as a lakoach and gave him the din of a yoresh, so that he doesn't have this extra ability to prevent giving the money to anybody else. So the reason is that where we have a halacha, that there is a din of being able to be toref lekuchos, remember what the basis of that halacha is. It is a takana of the shuk to enable people to deal with real estate transactions. Because if you cannot assure that your real estate transaction is going to be supportable and that you could be tore from lekuchas and so on, then you'll never have any insurance. You have no idea what is going on. Maybe this loan you'll never be able to collect, despite the fact that you had liens and so on and so forth. So therefore, there's normally a halacha that if somebody spent money on something, that we protect his money. Now, in this case, nobody spent money. We just gave this din to the husband in terms of strengthening his position vis-a-vis the family. In this case, we strip him of that additional position. This is what Rabbi Eloy is saying happened in Usha. that I don't understand, why do we need a takanas usha for this? We know that this was a takana of the chachamim on every almana. So what you're saying is ridiculous. Gedola mizo amru. Almanato nizonet min chasav. If a guy dies, even the property that was inherited by the daughter, his daughter, let's say that, oh, he only had a daughter, his daughter, and now her husband takes that over, and normally, even though this wouldn't be supported against Lekuchot, it is because of the fact that we gave him the rights to be a Lekuach. But the din is that even though he is a stranger, so to speak, he just married the daughter, you can go after him for the widow's support. And even though he's saying, I have a din of a buyer, you can't go after me. I was there first and I am protected. We tell him it's not true. In this case, we give you a din. Since you didn't spend any money on it, we're going to give you a din of an heir. If we give you a din of an heir, then we can go after you because of the fact that the almana is provided for by her ketuva. And in that sense, we look at it as a debt that was there before, even though obviously not a debt yet because the guy didn't die. This is all discussion how it works. But in any event, if that's true, that almana nizonet min chasav, so if he's alive, isn't it obvious that hu v'ishto mi boy? Why do I even need this so-called takanas usha? And I know that this is true, Rebbe Zera. Listen, there was a maitza that Ravin sent it to Shuva in a letter, and it said that Misha made, if somebody died, he leaves an almana and he leaves a daughter. The daughter was Yoreshim. The din is that, of course, his property is taken from the daughter, which is his estate, and she's an heiress. But what if she goes in and gets married? If she gets married, now the husband becomes, so to speak, the buyer. And therefore, we should not be able to be Torefim. The din is that she still is the Zonek Minachasav, and the Rabbanan considered him to be only a Yoresh. So the whole idea over here was already in effect centuries before this thing from Usha. This is part of what the clause in the Ketuvah providing Mizonis for Almana is. So I don't know what Rabbi Zeir is talking about. We do not need this Takana at all. And not only that, I mean, I could tell you that Amar Rabbi Yossi, over here. So, I skipped to the next one. This is, it just should say Rav Yehuda. Omar Rav Yehuda ben Achososh, Rav Yossi, Rav Chanina, it's the Rav Yossi, Rav Chanina, it gets confused in a minute, that I had such a maisa, and I went to ask the Chachamim what the halacha is, and they said, Almanatoni zonit min chasav, even though the daughter got married, and now the husband is the boss of the money that used to belong to his wife's father, who is now dead, and he left a widow, and that widow can collect from, they told me that widow can collect from the son-in-law, even though the son-in-law ought to be a buyer technically. So amana nizonet min chasav. So then why do I need the takanas usha? Isn't it obvious that hu v'ishto mi boy? Wouldn't it be clear that that would be the case over here as well? Now, it's not a very good question on the surface. And there's a lot of discussion. What the heck does this have to do with anything? I mean, the point over here is that the case of the almana, obviously, that when he had his chiyav, first of all, what does it have to do with his money? It has to do with only what it is that he's providing from the estate, and that was only after his death, and he has a chiyav to support his wife, so he let him go get a job. I don't understand. He's supposed to support his wife. What does that have to do with the estate that is no longer his because he gave it away? How are you bringing a raya from something that we just said goes into effect only in terms of inheritance, not to mention the fact that why would it automatically follow that he would be able to get money for himself, which what Rabbi Zeres was takonis usha, that he can sue the kids for his rent. How can he sue the kids for his rent? They say, you gave away your money. It's your tough luck. So what does this really have to do exactly with takonis usha? And some of the Rishonim, in fact, actually say that the Gemara's kasha was not, why do we need takonis usha? Of course we need takonis usha. But the question is, why do we need a takonis usha for the wife? Because, I mean, isn't it obvious that if the Chachamim said that there exists a lien on his property and he could actually take away from his son-in-law, who's an absolute stranger, and to get to feed his wife, so certainly that is still there when he's alive. And if she doesn't have anything to eat, forget about him. But if she doesn't have anything to eat, we should certainly be able to take it for her, right? And that was the only kasha. For him, it's true. For him, we really do need takonis usha. So suggest some of the Rishonim. Okay, anyway, but you can see that this is not as simple as it appears on the surface. And the Gemara answers, the truth is an obvious answer, that without the takonis usha, I would not necessarily say that just because this guy left money in the event of his death to provide for his almana, so therefore if his almana needs support in his lifetime, we can go after that money. Why? We'll tell him to go get a job. So what is that supposed to mean? After his death, he's left this for her because there's no one to take care of her. Isn't that the whole point? So we don't have anyone to take care of her, and therefore it was provided for her. In this case, without the takanas usha, we'll say, let the guy go to get a job. Let him go ahead and provide support for himself and for her. And what's he coming around to bother his son-in-law over here? He gave away his money. Kamash Malan, that's where Bilal is saying that even in this case, so what if he's 95 years old? Who cares? Go get a job, you lazy bum. What are you coming to collect the money that you gave away to the kids? Okay. So Kamash comes along to Takanas Usha that he can go after that money to support himself and his wife. Okay, now, how about this takana of Usha? Do we go along with Rabbi Eloy on this one? So, hilchatak avatei, olet hilchatak avatei. Well, I'll bring you a proof that we don't go along with Rabbi Eloy on this one either. Because we had this interesting story where once Rabbi Chanina and Rabbi Yonatan were standing and talking. All of a sudden, a guy runs over and he kisses Rabbi Yonatan's feet. So Rabbi Chanina said to him, what's going on over here? Why does this guy feel that you've, like, apparently you're God? Like, what's going on over here? He said, I'll tell you what happened. This poor guy had given away all of his money to his kids, and of course they messed him up and refused to give him a penny. And after all, Richie, don't forget those first-class airline tickets. I mean, you're really not expected to provide any money for dad, are you? So if that's the case, so he comes to me and he says, I don't have anything to eat. And I forced the kids to be mentioned and to feed the children. Now, if you're going to tell me that the halacha is like Rabbi Eloy, and that there is a standing takanas usha to this effect. So then, what do you mean? He's kissed your feet. I mean, you're just doing your job. You're basically a pakid and a bezdin, and you got a tviyah based on takanas usha, and you activated the tviyah. I mean, like, I understand every time a judge puts his signature on a din, which is like b'chuyev for him to say, so you go and kiss his feet. I mean, it's completely impersonal. So what's this special relationship? The guy feels that you care so much about him. It has nothing to do with caring about him. You did what you needed to do. So, iam rit b'shloma lav dina. If you're going to tell me it wasn't really mi'ikar adin in usha. So therefore, Rabbi Yonasan actually went lifnim mishurat adin to take care of this guy, whatever the circumstances were, whether it was through embarrassment or whatever it was. And therefore, the guy felt tremendous hakaras tova. But if you're going to tell me, Yamredino, Asinu, boy, what do you mean I forced him? You have to force him. The din forces him. That's the standing takana zusha. So why is the guy treating with Rabbi Yonason like, wow, you cared so much about me. You did me the biggest favor in the world. So obviously, Rabbi Eloi is apparently not lahalacha even in the second takana zusha. Now, once he's on a roll, we might as well hear the third takanas usha. And the third takanas usha, Amar Rabbi Eloi, is be'usha yitkino ha-mevazvez al-yevavzvez yoter mi-chomesh. Now, this is very nogel halacha, and the big machlok is about how to read it over here. Are we talking about specifically tzedakah, as some of the Rishonim say over here, or as we end up paskening halacha l'maisa, this is a psak halacha across the board. Namely, that a person who is going to be doing a mitzvah, Mukoshken, if he's spending money on providing other people with support because they need his help, don't give more than 1/5 of your money. Now, this is defined as, in the Yerushalmi, it's defined clearly. 1/5 of your principal. So you have money that you're living off. So you could take 1/5 of that, and then your income every year, you can give up to 1/5. You're certainly not chayev, but you can't give more than 1/5, because then you may cause yourself to end up needing support, and you have to take care of yourself first. That's your first chayev, and therefore don't give more than this. Some say it's in terms dafka of giving overly choshev gifts, because you're so moved by the plight of people that you're giving away your money, and you have to be careful not to overdo that. Others learn that this is bichlal, and this other Ramo Paskins, that bichlal, you don't have a chiev to give more. The ikerdin is the 10th. You shouldn't give more than 1/5 to a chiev even of a mitzvah. You don't give 1/5. So in other words, if your esrog is too expensive, you're not allowed to buy it, and so on and so forth. This would be a question of how much money are you mevazvez for kiyam ha-mitzvahs. Now, obviously, as the Rishonim point out here, we're not talking about chas v'sholom being over an isser. To be over an isser, you have to give everything you own, but to be mekayim a mitzvah, so you shouldn't give more than 1/5. I want to tell you a beautiful, beautiful story of a psak halacha, which was like, I remember I was so moved by this as a teenager. So Rav Moshe Feinstein, I was once in my grandfather's Atzal's house, and Rav Moshe calls him up, and he wants to discuss a very chomer shayla that he has. He wants to discuss with him. This is so brilliant. I was like, flipped. So the Maisa was like this, and he has a shayla of this guy who just had a son, and they're supposed to do a bris next week, and the urologist claims that there could very well be permanent damage to his penis because of the way that he was born and so on, and that a bris is a very delicate kind of thing for this kid. And so now Ramesha wants to know, so what should he tell him in terms of Mila Bismanaj? Should they just wait? Should they decide that it's the equivalent that you don't take any type of sakana? And is a sakana's aver? Is this considered to be a sakana's misa? And so on and so on. Like, presents a whole big shaila, right? Listen to this amazing sack. On the spot, my grandfather says to him, let me ask you something. Would this new father be happy to spend 25% of his bank account to save his kid's penis forever? I think so. So then he's not allowed to make the bris. It's worth too much. He's going to be spending more than a chomesh. And that's how Ramosha Paskin in the end. So it's mamish the, it's like to see the application in a way that you would never think. What is it? You think it has to be cash specifically? You don't give something that's worth more than chomesh. Amazing. Anyway, fine. So that is this halacha of the Takanas Usha. Tanya Nami Hachi. And the Braita says, Hamevazvez, al yevazvez yoter bichomesh. If you're going to give overly amount of money for either tzedakah or for mitzvahs, don't give more than 20%. Shama yitztarech lebriot. And there was once a maisa, one of the big chachomim, who wanted to give more than a chomesh. And his chaver, who was also a big Talmud Chacham, didn't allow it. Who was that chaver? That was Rabbi Yeshevav. He wouldn't allow it. Some say that, no, the maisa was Rabbi Yeshevav wanted to give more than he should. And his chaver didn't allow him. And who was his chaver? Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva put his foot down. You're not allowed to spend that kind of money. What's the mucker for this in the Torah? Omrav Nachman, Vitamer of Acher by Yaakov. Where do we see in the Torah not to give more than a chomesh? Because Yaakov Avinu says, Takarish Baruch Hu, V'chol asher titein li aser asrenu lach. So what's this aser asrenu? I mean, like what, you're telling HaKadosh Baruch Hu how much your toiva is worth to me? You're telling HaKadosh Baruch Hu, all right, I'm ready to give you 10%. You know, if you give me $1 million, I'll give you 100,000. I think it's a good deal for you, no? What is this supposed to be? So the pshat of aser asrenu. So what is this double lashon of aser? That's the point, that I'm limited. So Yaakov Avinu is saying, listen, I'm only allowed to give you 20%. Is that okay? So aser asrenu, I'll give you first miser, and I'll give you another miser. Wait a minute. You forgot how to do some simple math, my friend. Once you took out the first miser, you're only left with 90%. If you're taking 10% of the 90%, you only get 9%, which puts together the two gifts as 19%, and you said 20%. You said that we can give you a chomesh. Now you're bringing me a raya. You can't give a chomesh. You can only give 19%. So your mucker is the wrong mucker. Omar. Volodami. Isura batra lisura kama. The first tenth is not the same amount as the second tenth. Omar avashi. That's why it doesn't say aser aser. It says aser aserenu. Asrenu means I'll take the same tenth again. Asrenu, I'll do the act of misering the same amount of that original tenth. Lebatra kikama, the second time I'm going to do the same thing that I did the first time. Points out, Reb Shimi Barashi, let me tell you something. If you want to remember, okay, the structure of the Gemara that we just had, which were three different Rabbi Eloi Takanas Ushas, you'll notice that they go in order of lower number of people who said them. And they go very strangely that in, as you take a look at the original one, it says, Rabbi Eloi said in the name of Reish Lakish, who said in the name of Yehuda Bar Hanina. Okay, so there you've got three people. The second Rabbi Eloi, you had only Rabbi Eloi b'shem Reish Lakish. And the third Rabbi Eloi was just plain old Rabbi Eloi. Right? So you went down from 3 to 2 to 1 in order of the Shmuais. Now, if you want to remember who said what, because this can get very confusing, I'll give you a very simple simon so that you'll remember the orders of the Takanas Usha. And once you remember the order, you'll be able to reconstruct who said what, because you remember that it was in order of the way in which they were said. The way to remember is that kids wrote out the check and wasted all the money. A remez to Richie again. Ketanim katvu ubizbizu. So you're not allowed to write checks out for first class air tickets. But anyway, this reminds me that the first Maimer was about providing support for Ketanim, and the second one was the Ksuva that we talked about, and the third one is Al Yevazvez. So now you remember who said What?